You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another exciting...
Oh, Bruce, looks like Bruce cut out. We're going to say welcome back to another exciting episode of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron, who is oddly silent, and myself, Susan Giddings. So we're glad to see you. We've been gone for a couple of weeks, and hopefully Bruce comes back with us, but we're going to get started. You know, like I said, we've been gone for a couple of weeks, and you know, we answer page questions on the Facebook page, but we like to kind of take every so often take a time to answer just a variety of questions. And we're going to do that today. We've got just a hodgepodge of things. Let's see. Does Bruce have sound yet?
Okay. Am I on there yet?
You're
or
back.
Just soft. I'm back.
You're
but
just
barely
soft.
Back, huh? Okay. So well, at least I'm back.
That's he's back. Victory. He's back there. So Bruce, we're going to hit some of those questions on the Facebook page.
Let's do that.
Had some rumors posts. We had a question about FCI Estill and FCI, or actually FCI Aliceville.
Right, right.
And Aliceville will be undergoing a mission change. It's going to be converting to a low security male facility. And as you know,
wow,
we've had a shortage of male bed space male bed space has been a problem. Gosh, I was in the regional office and we were tracking low security bed space. It was such a challenge, you know, under the last administration,
sure
they eliminated the contract. So we had to bring a whole lot of low security folks back into custody, a whole lot of non-US citizens. So that further complicated that bed space.
Will they still do immigration stuff with the low?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I would assume that they will continue. I hadn't confirmed that, but I'm going to make an educated assumption that everything is set up for Aliceville. So it will make sense to have Aliceville continue as an IHP site. We'll have to, you know, time will tell on that. And time will also tell about if they're going to look to make Estill an IHP site for the females, or if they're going to look somewhere else, like perhaps Carswell, you know, it's not an IHP site. You know, it'll impact the access for females for hearings. The moving to Estill and reopening Estill, as everyone may know, or you would remember this, you know, several years
storms,
ago, Estill
yeah.
was hit with a hurricane and sustained damage. They evacuated the institution due to not having the funds. It has not been repaired. Money from the Big Beautiful Bill is being used to bring that up online. That's some of that one-time money that the Bureau got to make repairs. Back in 2023, they had announced that the satellite camp was going to undergo a mission change and they were going to move females there. And so this really just completes the mission change. It's really challenging to have an institution where the main institution is male and the satellite facility is female for just different logistic reasons. One really good thing is that for female offenders, low security offenders, Tallahassee, which of course is not on the coast, is in northern Florida. The next FCI, low security female bed space, is not until you get to Danbury, Connecticut. So putting Estill, which is, you know, right there on the South Carolina, Georgia border, putting additional bed space along that eastern seaboard is really good for our female offenders. The eastern seaboard is a high population area and they just haven't had the bed space. Of course, women only represent about 6% of the population.
That's right.
So it is a challenge, but when you look at the map and you see where Tallahassee is and you see where Estill is, and you look at Aliceville, Aliceville and Estill are really close geographically, same distance to Tallahassee, but by moving east and north to Estill, they're again opening up some opportunities for other women to be close to home. Again, we have Carswell in Texas that has a 500 bed female low security unit. So it's actually a good decision both for male low security individuals and for the females. Obviously, it's going to be disruptive for those folks who are at Aliceville, and Aliceville is the closest to their home. That's going to be a disruption, but from a, you know, from the prior unit management section chief and looking at beds and population,
right,
at a, you know, at that 35,000 foot view, it makes sense why the Bureau is doing it.
Exactly.
So, that was, saw that, both on our Facebook page and a few other sites. So wanted to kind of put that out there. Something else we saw put out, not by on our page, but on another site regarding the FCA time credit assessment periods and how that works.
FSA. In terms
of unit team. Yeah. And thought we should take a few minutes, and we've done it before. And of course, if you have our book, we go over it in detail. See, I'm flashing the book this time. We go over this in detail. So the way the FSA time period assessments work is they are independent and automated, meaning if the case manager is late teaming someone, their assessment period still happens. So the video clip that was posted had to do with the second assessment. So the first assessment happens at that 28 days. That's true for everybody across the board. If you are lower minimum risk walking in the door, that means at your second assessment, be it 90 days or 180 days later, you are now eligible for that 15-day earning rate. What happens is the case managers, 28 days, within 28 days for the initial team, that within 180 or 90 days, depending on the release date for that second team. Well, what if DSCC is late in completing the sentence computation? By policy, DSCC has 60 days to complete a sentence computation. Now, do they usually take that long? No. Can they take that long? Yes, particularly for individuals who maybe have some complicated jail credit issues that need to be looked at. Maybe there's some documentation they need. So they, by policy, have up to that 60 days. Case managers, yes.
Can they do the AR, just go back to their ARSD or whatever?
If they still get credit. The inmate is still getting... Okay. Those programming days back to their ARSD. But for the case manager, and this is where it gets a little hinky. So let's say the DSCC doesn't complete that sentence computation for 37 days. Case managers are not supposed to conduct that initial classification without the sentence computation being done for a variety of reasons, namely, things like the time credit calculator doesn't work unless the comp is done. FRP can't be entered unless the comp is done. Victim notification doesn't happen unless the comp is done. There are a number of things, number of automated systems, as well as manually entered systems that rely on that sentence comp. So it has to be done. So if your sentence comp doesn't get done to day 37 and your case manager, you know, teams you that next Monday or Tuesday, and now we're at 40, 41 days. Okay, they do that initial classification, enter in all that information. You as the individual, you're getting credit back to day one as long as you've done your part and done your assessments, right? But guess what? The case manager, they're not keying in your team for within 180 days of when you could have gone. They're doing it 180 days from when you did go to team.
Which
you don't go to team until, say, day 42, even if it's for legitimate reasons. 180 days later, that puts you, you know, now you're up at what, 120 plus days. The calculator will work and will post your credit at the 15 day interval when you hit 210 days. That's how it works. So it's done, honestly, to ensure that time credits and those assessments happen regardless of human error or human complication, or the institution is locked down. So teams get canceled and they get scheduled a week or two down the road. It eliminates all of that variability, which happens when humans are involved. So that's that. Now, for individuals who don't drop to minimum or low until later. So if you're a minimum or low from the beginning.
Pattern risk.
Huh?
Pattern,
right.
Pattern,
not security level. If you're minimum or low on pattern from the beginning, well, you've got 28 days and 180 days. But let's say you're not at that first team, and you don't drop to low until maybe your second team. So that's team number two. You have to maintain the two consecutive periods from there, which means instead of being able to take advantage of that first short 28-day period, you're going to have two full 180-day periods. You're going to have to wait that 360 days. And that is just a function of the law. And the last administration who pushed to have the first assessment period count as the 28 days. If I had been in charge of the world, it wouldn't have. Because of the way the law reads, that first 28 days shouldn't count. It would also put individuals who are at minimum and low risk on kind of parity with those who work their way down to minimum and low risk. As you and I have talked about it in a couple of things we've published, there is some disparity that happens within the law, and individuals who actually work their way down to minimum or low risk don't get to take full advantage of their time credits because they have a longer period of time that they have to maintain that lower minimum risk before they go to
get the eligibility to get them earned.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Applied, rather.
To apply them, right. They get to apply them immediately. They don't get that 15 days applied, is what they have that longer drawn out window. So it takes them longer to get to the 15 day intervals to where their time really starts to, those credits really start to accumulate quickly. Also had a question regarding, with regard to pattern. In fact, just saw it. Person had been, a family member posted, the person had been in custody for, I believe they said 2 years, clear conduct, doing a lot of programming, isn't seeing their pattern risk level change. What I would say and what we've talked about is not all programs count toward pattern. We do specifically address it in the book in chapter 3, I believe. We address it. We also list the kinds of programming that do count. And it's kind of confusing because a lot of the EBBR, official EBBRs and PA programs, productive activity programs, don't actually count toward pattern. And, the obvious question is, well, why is that? Well, because pattern is developed externally. The Bureau has no control over the points that are assessed, what programs count and don't count, what the cut points are. That is all done externally. The good news is that we get further into the data, and this is like the little geek in me talking, the further we get into the data and we have these EBBRs and productive activities that were established either post FSA or were standardized with FSA. And that's important for collecting data. As an example, anger management, There were any number of anger management programs floating around the Bureau prior to FSA. With the passage of FSA, they identified which anger management program was going to be used system-wide, standardized the curriculum and the hours and how it was going to be done, and from a research standpoint, standardized the coding for it. So now we have a number of years kind of where we're collecting data with the same coding so that outside entity, when they do a validation on pattern and they're using data since FSA, because if you recall to do that research, it's cohorts of people that have already been released. So they're looking at people who have been released and taken those programs. So I suspect over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, we're going to see more and more programming added to pattern eligibility, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
So, but that's what I would say to our Facebook member is, what programs are you taking? Because it might not be the right ones.
And then they can call us as well.
And they can give us a call as well. But that's something I think a lot of people struggle with, is they're maintaining clear conduct, they're taking programming, yet they're just not seeing that the needle move. The other problem, and again, not in the Bureau's control, but the two heaviest weighted items in pattern is first age. And so, like, crime is a young man's game, right?
You're right.
So as you get older, your risk decreases. That is nothing but time. You can't do anything about that. The other one, which I have a growing appreciation for, is the criminal history points. The criminal history points are scored based on what is in the PSR at the time of sentencing. The Bureau doesn't age them. So the weight value of them doesn't change based on how long you've been in custody. And that's problematic. I was actually at a conference with federal public defenders prior to my retirement. Yes.
Like some of the stuff people will say, oh, well, that violence was 10 years ago or more than 10 years ago. Why doesn't it? Right.
Right. So violence and escape do age just like they do on custody classification. As they get older, they become worth less points. Criminal history doesn't. And that is one of the most heavily weighted items in pattern. And so you could be sitting there and have 5 years in custody, clear conduct, programming. Yet if you were hell on wheels prior to your federal bid, the points you're stuck with is heavy. And it stays with you. It stays with you on custody classification, and it stays with you in pattern. And there is no aging to those points. And so then you're left with those points that do age, history of violence, history of escape, but the programming points, whether that's substance abuse treatment, that's education, that's work programming, and then other programming. So, but it's got to be the right programs.
Right.
Had some questions about RDAP and when dates change on the release date. So that is a complex question. So let's start with the easy part of this. When an individual goes into RDAP, goes through the review process, is determined to be 3621E early release benefit eligible, that information is plugged into the sentence computation. And that year off is presumed. And you will see individuals with that 3621E conditional date.
That's if they're DAP part. They have to be DAP part.
Yeah, you got to be in the program first. You go through the qualification process first. You get into the program. Then there's that eligibility review where they determine, and that's actually done outside the institution. It's actually the review process is at DSCC. and they make that decision, and voila, you're either eligible or not eligible. Once they determine eligibility, they automatically plug that in. Now, for the person who's earning time credits at the same time, what will happen is, as that conditional, that RDAP conditional date, that 3621E conditional date, becomes an FS RDAP conditional date. And that will continue to advance each month. You'll have good conduct minus a year or whatever, up to the year, whatever you're eligible for. Let's assume you're getting the full year off of RDAP. And then each month that you get time credits posted, then the RDAP conditional date changes. When at the end of your sentence, when the case, or toward the end, and when the case manager is submitting that paperwork to the halfway, to the reentry office, and they get a designation date, we now know you're going to halfway house on this date, June 15th, right? Whatever it is. There is another form that is completed by the unit team that is sent to DSCC. It's called a BPA0628. It is the only part of FSA that is still a manual process and is challenging. And what happens is the case manager has to enter three pieces of information in addition to a person's name and number. When they completed RDAP, when they're transferring to halfway house, and how long they're supposed to be there. If the case manager plugs in the current release date, that's what's going to lock in. If they use the current conditional, if they use the current date as their reference point of transfer to halfway house and the release date, that date gets locked in. If they use the conditional release date, the conditional date gets locked in. What happens when the release date is plugged in, there are folks in Washington, D.C. that in the community treatment specialist branch, community treatment branch, that are quite literally tracking every single person sitting in halfway house across the country. And prior to, and they have, when they know when they need to submit that guy's or gal's paperwork, and they have to do an updated, manually updated form that gets signed and sent to DSCC, and DSCC enters the new date information. Okay, so before this summer's change with home confinement, it was kind of a pain in the butt. Okay. But weirdly enough, the home confinement date based on the release date actually continues to change each month, even though what you will see looking in-house and what you will see if you're looking at the public website, that date just seems to be frozen. And you're like, what the heck? My date's not changing. The home confinement eligibility date is changing. But here's what's not changing. Whatever the date locks in, home confinement eligibility, as they're using it today, right, is locked based on the release date. So if they plug in use the conditional date to calculate the number of days in halfway house, well, then it will at least use the conditional date minus the SCA home confinement. Now, here's the other problem. There's always a problem, isn't there? The other problem is the Bureau is now also using, for folks who have more than 365 days of time credits and are in halfway house, either for all of or part of their SCA placement, SCA and FSA, right? They are using the placement date to then determine the max eligibility for home confinement. That date will never appear currently, whether the case manager uses the conditional date or the current date. Okay. And although these changes have been coming, I think they just didn't see that unless you either worked in RDAP unit and you understand the date changes because you were dealing with it before. Even before we had the conditional release date calculator and all that kind in there, we had reentry offices as well as institutions going and trying to figure it out, right? Remember, we had a client, the case manager tried to figure it out and he kind of used the wrong, his math wasn't on. This was before we had the conditional release date calculator, and they were trying to help, and it kind of bogged up his home confinement. That's what's still happening. And I don't know the fix, because they are not using anything that's in Sentry, and the that system is what is used to track release dates and stuff, right? We have this extra date over here that the calculator is calculating, and it's on the FSA worksheets. But right now there's no way to extract that information, and the 628 form, when it locks up the release date, it's locking up the home confinement eligibility
as well. Yeah.
As well. So it's a challenge. It's another kind of thing. And I'm sure we'll see it in the future soon. I know they were looking at it even before I retired. They were looking at the issues, and it's just a matter of, it's so intricately tied into the sentence computation, which is critical, because now we're talking about liberty interests, right? And we don't want people's release dates being messed up. And not, I'm not even talking about earned time credit. I'm talking about like statutory release dates. It's just not a quick fix. You know, it's one of those things that they're going to want to test. They're going to want to code, and they're going to want to test and test and test. Because what they don't want to do is screw up the sentence comp module.
Well, yeah. And you don't want to let somebody out early. You want to wait theoretically till around 120 days of treatment time to make sure that the person's going to have a successful discharge summary produced by the community treatment provider, so that they don't want to honor the 3621E part unless the inmate's fully satisfied the community-based treatment portion of the RDAP.
Absolutely. Right? So,
I could
and
see
it's not
I
even a want if they can't. They can't honor that. I mean, the law restricts that. You
correct.
Know?
Yes. Yes. Correct. So just to let y'all know that baseline of 120 days of community treatment's kind of the what the law says as a bare minimum to be able then to earn the 3621E release. And what Susan's point is that we have multiple methods. We have multiple release methods, and even more than that, in terms of, you know, when you add home confinement and Second Chance Act placement on top of that. So there's a statutory date we don't want to go beyond, but I think it's this if then else. If I remember writing Fortran back in the day, and remember my coding experiences, such as they were, you know, you have this kind of priority, right? Of okay, this needs to be satisfied. Then we go over here. Then we look at see the time accrued, right? That's the else, the time accrued in the interim to see where we are now with possible, you know, home confinement or not. So,
absolutely.
The good thing is, and I'll say this, everybody, the good thing about the RDAP is now we're living in an age that many people won't get both halfway house and home confinement. I said it last week. We keep on hearing this, right? They're just sending people out on home confinement. Well, if you're an RDAP, regardless of where you are, you've got to do that first 4 months somewhere. And if you get that could help you get halfway house and home confinement.
Because aren't they reticent? I mean, I know they did it during COVID, but aren't they kind of reticent to do 100% of the community treatment?
Absolutely. I don't want to send
you in house.
No, man. Yeah. When I was a CTS person and to say, oh, by the way, go to your weekly therapy appointment, the dudes at the house, hell no. I mean, they're not, I mean, okay. I wouldn't want to go. If I'm the inmate, man, I'd be like, look, let's put you in the halfway house. Let's put you through A&O, get you a bed assignment. Okay, we'll figure out work later, but you're going to go to therapy once a week. Click, 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 click. You know, kind of get going on that.
Right.
So that the inmate doesn't even accidentally or whatever screw himself or herself up on that. Because if they miss a couple appointments, right?
They could be looking at losing the entire year. They fail out. So, they fail. They get adapt fail. They've lost a lot.
So that is a good point. So don't see as going to halfway house. If you're an RDAP person and you do get some halfway house, don't see that as punitive. You're going to get your home confinement, but we want to make sure that you're getting your treatment squared away. Right.
And for those sitting out there who are thinking, well, wait a minute, they put me in direct home confinement. Does it happen? Sure.
Sure.
Did it happen during COVID? Absolutely. There was, because we were pushed, the Bureau was pushing out a lot of people going to those 628s. We saw 628s with 1200 days, 2000 days, that we were pushing a lot of people out because of COVID. So were people doing 100% of their, what we used to call TDAT, now community treatment
CTS,
time,
CTS
time in home confinement? Yes, it happens. Could it be a situation where, depending on remote locations and things like that, where maybe a person is put on federal location monitoring and is allowed to do their community treatment strictly from home confinement? Absolutely. Is that going to be the rule? I sincerely doubt that, for the very reasons that Bruce is talking about.
Right. So,
Had some things going on. We've been seeing since December some hiccups, we'll call them, with some folks not to be getting credit posted. Just saw a post on the Facebook group maybe yesterday, day before, I don't recall, within the last few days, that the person said their credit just posted and they posted 30 days worth. The program works. The problem is let a data file come into the program and there's something quirky in the data file, right? Computers only work, programming only works, and I am not a programmer, but I have learned more about computer programming than I ever wanted to. But computer programs only work when the data comes to the program as expected. Meaning configured as expected. And if it comes in there and the data is quirky, maybe there's a date misalignment or something's going on, the system's going to go, what the hell is this? Excuse my language. What the heck is this? And we'll kick it out. So just as a rule of thumb, if your loved one is sitting there and you see their date updated every month around the 22nd, and this month rolls along and you don't see anything on the 22nd, the 23rd, 24th, always remember, on the public side, there is a delay. But if he's going and it's more than a week or so, like, he needs to be talking to his case manager. And if the case manager is like, well, I don't know, then talk to the case management coordinator, talk to the unit manager, talk to the associate warden, the warden. If something isn't happening the way it's supposed to, and this isn't a new procedure, this was in place when I was still working, the expectation was the institution is supposed to reach out to the regional office in correctional programs, and then they're looking at it. And then when I was still working, I would then get an email from somebody in a regional office that says, hey, name, number, da, 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 give me some information. I would look it up. I would look at it. And then at the time it was just me. I'm hearing they're looking at building an entire FSA branch, which I think is really exciting. Apparently they needed a branch to replace me, but that's okay.
It's true.
I would look at it, and then I would reach out to the computer folks to say, hey, need to force a pattern. Hey, can you force time credit, a time credit calculation on this one person? See if we can figure out what's going on. And sometimes forcing it just fixed it. Like whatever was weird is not weird. Okay. Other times, maybe the case manager or maybe somebody keyed something wrong. I've had some weird things when I was troubleshooting cases when I was still working. And sometimes weird stuff just like happens. I mean, it, you know, crap happens. That's kind of life. But don't let something delay. If your loved one is sitting there, they haven't earned 365 days yet. They've gone, it's been 30, 40 days since a time credit is posted and they should be getting something and they need to be talking to people. And if they're getting pushback, they can call us or you can call us on behalf of your loved one.
Or what's even more scary.
I don't want everybody calling us. We don't want, try to get it resolved. If you can't though, that's what we do because we know who to talk to. Bruce.
Yes. Am I still on?
You are.
Yes. Particularly for you individuals that are sitting in a federal halfway house that really don't have a case manager. You're a person without a country, right? Because they're going to say, oh, I don't know anything. All I know is what the Bureau tells me. So it's just you and the RRM and even still with the RRM. Hey, man, I'm not, you know, we're not going to do a whole lot. Boy, that's when you need to call us.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And I'll tell you, just like some case managers are better than other case managers, some case management coordinators are better than other case management coordinators. The same is true in the reentry offices. You have an RRC, a halfway house. That's the halfway house. Their official name is a reentry center. You've got a local case manager. That case manager may be super responsive and is reaching out to the reentry office, the Bureau's reentry office, and maybe they're not. And then you get to that reentry office and some are super responsive and are trying to do the right thing. And others are maybe a little overwhelmed and they're not. They, you know, whatever the reason mm-hmm. is, but don't let something go 60, 70, 80 days.
No, you know, don't do that. Yeah.
If you've tried locally and you're not making, doing it, that's the time to reach out. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So let me look at my list of things we were going to talk about. We talked about the updating. Oh, saw questions, couple of questions about intake, A&O, just kind of general about the institution. There was a specific question also about getting a PAC number. When you get to the institution, you should be getting a PAC number by the next business day. Okay. You know, if you get in, if you arrive early, you know, you're a voluntary surrender and you show up by 10 o'clock in the morning and your correctional counselor is in that day, you might get it the same day as you arrive. If you're not getting released until, you know, at my institution, we didn't release guys off the bus. We didn't release them from R&D until the 10 p.m. just prior to
the 10
p.m.
What is the PAC number? What is the PAC number?
The PAC number is that number, that access ID number that you're going to use for like the phone and calling people. Yep. You're going to get set up with that number and your counselor is the one that gets it. They call over the trust fund. They get you a number. It's yours. Like, remember it. But yeah, you should get that. It's by end of the business, next business day, you should have it. There's, unless your correctional counselor is literally out on administrative leave, not administrative leave. What did I mean? Annual leave, not administrative. Sick, administrative leave is bad.
That would be very bad.
That annual leave or sick leave. And then you can talk to your unit manager. They might have another counselor handling his caseload or her caseload. But there is no reason that a person should be sitting in an institution for a week or two and not have their PAC number to call home. Period. That's Perfect. Not acceptable. And I say this even as a retiree, that's just not acceptable.
Yeah, true. True that.
Make sure I'm paying attention to the time because, you know, sometimes I talk too much.
11 minutes. 10 and a half.
11 minutes. All right. So last thing to talk about, and we've just seen some different things. We've had some questions asked of us going to state cases and federal cases and concurrent and consecutive and jail credit and all of those things. And sometimes those can get really complicated. What you need to be thinking about, one, is that jurisdiction question. If we get the calls all the time, and the first question I ask is, who arrested you first? I'm usually talking to a family member, right? Who arrested you first? And I'll always hear, well, he got arrested by the sheriff, but then he had a federal detainer put on him. The marshals put a hold on him. Doesn't matter. In custody. Why was he in custody? Why did the sheriff pick him up to start with? What, did the sheriff pick him up because he had a federal warrant? Or did the sheriff pick him up because he had a state warrant? Was he arrested because he got arrested for a state charge? You know, like, why? What put him in contact with law enforcement first? Who took him into custody? Because right. That question of custody goes to what's known as jurisdiction, whether it's primary or secondary jurisdiction. Who has primary jurisdiction? When we're looking at cases and we're doing sentence comp assessments and we're talking to folks, we're asking them, nope, we need you to send us this and send us this. And we will literally build a timeline and who bonded out from where and when were they bonded out and what happened then. Those are important questions. The other big question in terms of jail credit is you don't get credit, well, for the most part. There are some weird little exceptions. We won't talk about the weird little exceptions. But for the most part, if you are getting credit, jail credit, if you were in jail prior to, let me back up, sorry. If any time prior to sentencing, federal sentencing, is prior custody credit. We used to call it jail credit. Officially, it's prior custody credit. If any time of that prior custody credit was credited to another charge, to a state charge, it isn't prior custody. You don't get it. You don't get to double dip. There are some situations where there's a possibility for overlapping prior custody credit where you were in prior custody credit for both the Fed and the state at the same time. But once the state sentences you, that becomes state time. Prior custody credit can only be awarded to one place. It either goes to a state or it goes to the feds. And like I said, there's some quirky littleness for a little bit, but those are very obtuse cases and practically require a PhD in sentence comp to map out. We can do it here, but it's a challenge. But remembering that is super important. We've seen a couple of cases where judges have will have someone call us and they'll say, well, he was sentenced to 36 months, but the judge gave him credit for 10. And the first question we ask is, what was the 10 months? Did he actually just recommend he be given credit for 10 months? Or did he say, okay, I'm giving you credit for the 10 months, so 36 minus 10 is 26, and your sentence is 26. And that makes a difference in what the judgment, how the judgment reads. We do it all the time. You know, someone calls us, and the first thing we say is, do you have access to the judgment? What does the judgment say? And that makes a difference. So I know it's complicated, and it's frustrating for a lot of folks who, particularly when they've been in custody prior to their federal bit, or they were dealing with some dual incarceration where they had a federal case and a state case going on and people were bonding out and arresting and going to court, and they kind of get lost and they're just looking at the fact that, and understandably so, they're just looking at the fact that I've been arrested and in custody for the last 4 years. Where is my credit? Okay. Yeah. And that's a problem. The other thing when it comes to state and federal custody and those kind of competing sentences is the Bureau doesn't care if the state judge ran something concurrent. The Bureau is looking at what did the federal judge do, because the Bureau is dealing with the federal sentence. We've seen some interesting cases where the individual, for instance, there was a case where we had the documentation where the state paroled the individual. There was a marshal detainer. The marshal picked him up. Okay. Well, the documentation from the marshals, though, that the marshals gave the Bureau was the day they picked him up, not the day that he was paroled. And it was about 12 days, if I remember the case correctly. Right. But that individual was being held past his parole date, pending marshal pickup. He gets credit for that time because those days, those 12 days, were not being attributed, were not being applied to that state case, but the Bureau didn't have the documentation. The Bureau had the marshals telling him, this is when we took possession of him. So the Bureau gave him credit starting on that date with the marshals because the marshals gave them incorrect information. You know, ultimately, we still have human beings involved, and if they don't enter the right date information, that's why documentation is important.
That's right.
So, but those are, and I know we have just a couple of minutes left. Do you want to talk about our books and things like that?
Sure. I mean, real quick, the blue book that Susan just had is The Eminent Authority on the First Step Act, First Step Act Credit, how it's implemented. Hands down, the number one source of that. If you haven't gone into federal prison yet and you're undergoing the process, particularly if your pre-sentence report hasn't been done yet, you want to get our green book. I don't know if you have that by you. The green book, which I did a video on that a few minutes ago, and it was advertised in the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And that book is about classification. You want to make sure, there you go, there's a green book, yay. And so you definitely want to get that book as well. These are great bestsellers. And so we've been blessed to be able to self-publish and use the Amazon platform, have those shipped in to your loved ones, one for you, one for your loved one. And that way it gives you some semblance of control of what's going on in your life, you know, knowing about these things. So please do that. And real quick, a public service announcement. I got two calls today. Some of you guys are just brazen. Hello, Mr. Cameron. I'm John Doe from FPC blah blah camp. These dudes are calling us, Susan, like a phone booth. Do not call us from the institution. Have a family member or liaison call us. We're not going to talk to you if you're in the institution. You got to get rid of that cell phone, y'all.
Don't message us on Facebook either.
Yeah, don't do that.
I've had more than one direct message on Facebook that they're explaining to me exactly where they are, and they get deleted and blocked. Not going to, you know, if you're going to screw yourself up, you're going to do it on your own.
We're not going to do it for you. So please refrain from that.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway, that wraps up another fantastic show here on Around the Block. Glad you could join us. Welcome back. And now that we're back. So again, listen to our YouTube. We have a YouTube channel, First Step Act. We have our First Step Act, early release from federal prison, Facebook group, fantastic group there. Of course,
over 17,000, I think now.
17,000, you know, based on attraction rather than promotion, the little site that could. So proud of it. And thank you, you and your family members and everybody, the attorneys. We have judges, we have BOP staff, it's a wonderful group that we have on there, interesting group of people. So thank you for that. Come to the LA Talk Radio site. You can download our videos. You can download the MP3 files. It's all there for you for free at 24 hours on demand. Otherwise, we're on Apple Podcast, Amazon Audible, and a lot of other podcast aggregators. So we're so blessed to have that. So anywho, great to see everybody. And yep. We'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. See you next time.
Take care, bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.